This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Geekscapists, welcome to a brand new Geekscape podcast. I'm Jonathan London, your host. If this is your first Geekscape, well, where have you been for the last 15 years? No. We are not going to start this show with shaming you for not knowing about Geekscape. It's totally cool. And I imagine a lot of you have not heard of Geekscape because our numbers have been bananas in the last month. This is a show that, as far as the downloads go, we've quadrupled in the last month. I don't know what that is about. I really don't, but if you're doing word of mouth, if you're sharing this with your friends, if you are telling your friends to subscribe, if maybe you're watching this on YouTube and you've become a podcast listener on any podcatcher that we're available on, all those things have really, really helped. So if you're watching this on Facebook, Twitch, YouTube, or I just added my LinkedIn. Maybe you're watching on LinkedIn. I don't know. You're a business professional or you're looking for a job. I don't really know. Maybe you're watching this on Twitter. If you're watching this, I love having you. Hit a share button, hit a subscribe button, whatever you got, and be a part of this next week. If you're listening on the podcast app, which is where a lot of you are, I really do appreciate it. Hit whatever share button you've got on your podcast app. Share Geekscape with your friends and just know that there's a ton of awesome stuff coming up in the Geekscape. We have got some new shows. I went to hang out with the $2 late fee guys. They're new to the network. $2 late fee celebrates all this 80s music and film. They've got Barry Boswick from Megaforce coming up on the show. I know that they have a ton of these 80s stars on the show, and they're a lot of fun. We tried to go see Moonfall. The projector broke. I ended up watching Scream. I enjoyed it. But if you want to hear more about it, you probably should go over to the Horror Movie Night podcast over here on Geekscape. They're a good one. And we also added Masters of the Media. 2 weeks ago, y'all really enjoyed Garrett Briones being a guest. Well, he and his roommate Jack do a show now on the Geekscape Network called Masters of the Media. And this episode they just put out, we got the Batman coming out, Matt Reeves' Batman movie with Robert Pattinson. And they took a look at Frank Miller's Batman Year One in this most recent episode. And they're like, okay, let's take a look at Frank Miller's Batman Year One and let's talk about how some of this stuff might end up in Matt Reeves' movie. It's kind of cool. Compare and contrast the comic books to the film. It's a new show here on Geekscape. And I told y'all we were going to put up that new show about undiscovered Hollywood scripts. And the first one's out now. Just search for it. All that information is on our socials. Follow Geekscape and all that. Okay, enough of the plugs. We have an amazing show for y'all coming up. My good buddy Jonah Tullis is on. He's directed this documentary about, do y'all remember this? A year ago when GameStop did like a short squeeze on all these hedge funds in Chicago and New York. And we just saw this GameStop stock go from like $2 to $40 to like hundreds of dollars. And as we were watching it in July, just of last year, we were like, whoa, this GameStop stock is going through the roof. And then there was all sorts of controversy with people in Robinhood. There was a congressional hearing. It's a crazy story, and it happened it literally happened a year ago. So how did I hear about the story becoming a documentary that's in theaters now? My friend Blake Harris produced it, of course. Blake, you know him from Console Wars. He's been on the show many times. Well, he produced the movie along with Jonah Tullis, and they basically did a 12-month plus dash to get this thing in theaters right now. It's available, and you should watch it. I saw the film yesterday. And it's a crazy story. Jonah's on the show to tell you all about it. So let's get a little Geekscape going. What do you say?
Comics, movies, random
Hey, Geekscapists, welcome to Geekscape. Thank you for joining us. If you're watching live, well, this is like 2 in the afternoon here in Los Angeles. But if you're listening on the podcast, which majority of you are, maybe you're out there on a run, or you're at work, or you're driving in your car. However you're listening to Geekscape, I'm just glad you're with us because we've been putting the show out for free for 15 years. And all we ask in response, or in return, I think is the term. I think that's it. All we ask in return, let's get in your hosting gear, Jonathan, is you share the love. However you want to do that. Maybe it's sharing an episode with your friend, or it's joining one of our social media accounts, or sending me an email, jonathan@geekscape.net, and being like, hey, Jonathan, you do a good show, or this is how it could be better, or I hate your guts. Whatever you want to send, it doesn't matter. You're all a part of it. Okay, GameStop, Rise of the Players. Let's get Jonah in here and tell you about this crazy story. He's coming in from New York. And Jonah, thanks for joining the show, buddy.
Thanks for having me.
I like seeing New York through your windows. Those of you who are listening, you can't see it, but I have a fond memory of living in New York at this time. And being like, you know what, when's this cold going to go away? And then it doesn't go away till April. But it's nice to look at, you know. How are you holding up in this winter?
You know, today was one of those days where it kind of felt like it was about to turn. But then I remembered it's February. And yeah, maybe we got a day or two and then it's going to be 15 degrees again. But whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So
that is the most New York attitude. For living in those conditions, that this guy here in sunny California can just like, I can say that and be like, you know what, man? Like, I think that is such a New York thing. And I was talking to a filmmaker last week, and she's in Queens and she grew up in Brooklyn. And she was like, you know what? This is just the way it is. This is what part of who I am. And I was like, does it have to be? I maybe just have like thin skin or something. I can't do the cold, man. But you're there and you got good reason to be there. Cause Blake is nearby. How did you meet Blake Harris?
Well, it's funny. Blake, who, you know, directed Consoles with me and wrote the book Console Wars. We actually went to high school together, but we were a year apart. So we didn't really know each other. We like knew of each other. And after college, we were playing on an adult softball team and started throwing around ideas. He was doing a lot of sort of creative writing. I was doing a lot of filmmaking and like sort of doing a lot of corporate type gigs at the time. And we came together and started this partnership that's kind of evolved into what it is today, which is sort of, it's, you know, obviously we do scripted, but and Blake does a lot of books, but we're also sort of doing a lot in this premium doc space, which has been like so fun and so exciting, I think.
It is kind of crazy that, you know, he writes this book, Console Wars. The Geekscape is, if you're a longtime Geekscape listener, you're more than familiar with Console Wars because Blake's been on the show several times. Y'all put the documentary out. I think it premiered at South by a few years ago. And what luck that you had a lot of that filmmaking background, but also that infrastructure in place. Because whereas that documentary took a little bit of time. It wasn't.
I don't know. It did take a long. I mean, there's a big story.
I didn't want to say it took forever. Now you had that all in place because this documentary did not take a long time because the events that you're documenting just happened last year.
Well, I would say the last one took a long time. You know, it's actually funny. The book, we brought the book and the book idea and the doc idea to Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg and James Weaver at Point Grey. And they decided to get on board for everything. Seth helped him set up the book, and Scott Rudin at the time as well, set up the book. They financed the initial parts of the doc, and then they set up a movie version that Seth and Evan were going to direct to Columbia Pictures. And then things just got slow in the Hollywood side, and then we were waiting for more funding. But Blake was still able to release the book pretty early, and then we were on hold for a little bit. And then, you know, in due fashion, we were supposed to premiere at South by Southwest and then go into theaters. And unfortunately, you know, COVID happened that month. But thankfully, we had a really big release in September of that year, which was exciting. And, you know, it was a wild ride. This one was sort of kind of came into my lap in a funny way. Somebody who loved Console Wars was like, you got to figure out this GameStop thing. Like, before it was really picking up steam.
This would crazy. Be like September of 2020, maybe?
It was a little later than that. It was just more like December at the time. So it was really picking up, and I was kind of looking at it, and I kind of got embedded with some of these subjects as this was all going on. And I saw the story developing. And meanwhile, there's all sorts of other Hollywood projects getting announced. And it was pretty wild. And I kind of took a look at the people who were committed to making this film with me and, you know, went to our partners at Submarine Entertainment. And we decided to go for it. I mean, it really was much like Console Wars. It's like, wow, these people are so interesting. Well, Console Wars, it was, they didn't have to be a video game company. They could have been a tissue company and doing the same kind of, you know, inventive marketing techniques and would still be interesting to me. And I found the same sort of people in that story.
But I mean, this is also the kind of thing where, I mean, with Console Wars, that story, like you said, is so good. It also just happens to be about Sega and Nintendo. And that gives you that built-in audience. And knowing Blake for as long as I've known him, he's a fan of this stuff. You know, and although what you say is true, that the characters in the story are that good, the fact that y'all are passionate about this stuff and just know the material really, really, really shows. And it showed in that book. The book was phenomenal. And then it showed in the documentary. This feels like if Blockbuster stuck together, or if, I mean, let's take the example from your film. Like if Blockbuster sticks together and they start putting out these two packs of DVDs, this one, GameStop, in Console Wars would have been packaged and sold together once they were like in a discount bin. Does that make sense? They share DNA.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, when we first looked at this story, you know, it was obviously a lot of research. We're talking about 15, 20 hours of interviews before we even sit down with them just to understand their story and who they are and talking to all sorts of
these are people. Over the phone. This is
over
Zoom
the phone, some Zoom and some over the phone. I feel like you would do some, you would do the ones on the phone, kind of get sort of the sense of who they are and do Zoom when you kind of wanted to see what they were like on camera. I think that's a part of it. But you know, it's a story about financing, about people who were involved with finance during COVID pandemic, which meant they were at their computers. And this Console Wars is a business story that happened 30 years ago. So we didn't have a lot of footage behind the scenes. So we had to bring you in that world in an interesting way. And of course we did with the animation and sort of, you know, taking you back into that world and into that in an interesting, fun way. And I think that, you know, you can't really use that kind of gaming animation in anything but a movie like Console Wars or Rise of the Players.
Right. And in a way, like stylistically, at least, it does share that DNA, but they are still animations. And this is a really truncated schedule for any film that y'all were working with. So in December, let's go back to your story of putting this thing together. In December of 2020, you're starting to think about what is happening. At that point, the stock is starting to show life. And GameStop is a stock that people were, and it's documented in the film, you should all see it. People were just lambasting GameStop as being a trashy place. As somebody in the comments was saying earlier, yes, they only gave trade-ins on like games for like penny credits, right? Like, I mean, I think everybody watching this or listening to this has gone into GameStop for a trade-in and been like, you got to be kidding me, dude. This is a brand new game that I've only played for a month and you're giving me $3 for it or something like that. We've all felt that way about GameStop. The stock is dead. A lot of people believe it's dead. Yet there were these few people who were saying, there's something that's going on here and it's going to pop. And I think by the time you started seeing it and we all started seeing it in December 2020, it had started to have like some life built around the pandemic and we're all playing video games. We're stuck there for a bit, maybe some massive like underestimation of the stock. But who thought it was going to pop like it popped here beyond the people who are in this film? A lot of this is just about faith, too.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think, listen, initially, you know, way back in 2018, when some of our, you know, investors were getting involved with this, it was, okay, this is $2, but maybe it can be worth $5 or $6. You know, it's not a bankrupt company. Yes, the shorts are going after it, but they have cash. They have, you know, the cash on hand out. I believe there are certain points where the cash on hand was more valuable than, you know, their stock showed. And so that was sort of the initial thesis. And then as things
GameStop. Cash on hand.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So sort of as things progressed, you know, one thing on top of the next, and you learned that Microsoft also had a digital revenue sharing deal with them. So it wasn't all that. You know, characters like Rod Alsman in our film were sourcing online orders during COVID and kind of seeing that, oh wow, their online business is picking up. And at the same time, Ryan Cohen kind of came in as the white knight and brought new life to the idea that this could be an e-commerce company. That being said, while I was filming, I went into a couple GameStops and they're some of them are still pretty sad. You know, they're still not.
Yes.
They feel like a relic of a bygone era, but there is this exuberance and this nostalgia to it that brought people back to trying to save it. And I do think you're going to go to a GameStop in a year or two, and it's going to look a lot different. You know, it's not going to have that terrible carpet. It's going to, you know, it's not going to be one of those empty places without energy. And one of those things that we, you know, touch on in the movie is the Tulsa experiment, which was where they kind of went into GameStops in Tulsa and kind of completely revitalized them and made them more of an interactive experience, which I think, you know, once we start dealing with esports, what if a GameStop could be, you know, an esports venue mm-hmm. on a small scale? You know, there's a lot of different ways it could go, and sort of all of these ideas and the fact that GameStop is the name in gaming, you know, they are the name for retail gaming. There was value there.
Yeah. And a lot of us just didn't see it because we'd lived through Blockbuster. And that's the comparison you get a lot of times in the early parts of this movie, is that while the stock is $2 and companies are shorting it, big hedge funds are shorting it in the hopes that it bankrupts and they at least make that $2 short on a wide swath. There is that thing going on, the pandemic, the e-commerce, the PS5 and Xbox One being really, really hard to find, but every single console they're selling. The other things that are going on was, I think I noticed during the pandemic when the GameStop started opening up again, you'd walk in and they started to have a lot of tabletop. They started like expanding things, not just into their figures and stuff, because that had been happening where you go and get action figures and things like that at the GameStop, but you were actually starting to see them not just do video games, but starting to do tabletop, and tabletop was exploding at the time too. So I think you're right. In a year, we may go in here and into a GameStop, and maybe you start seeing it not just look a little bit more like what you said, a Best Buy, where maybe there's some places to play games and maybe those games are wired into a hub, but you also see some tabletop games, more like a socialization center of a GameStop, which coming out of a pandemic, people might actually want.
That was the essence of the Tulsa experiment.
It's crazy.
That was the sort of, it was, and also like kind of build your own computers and sort of learning that element of things. I think there's a lot of, you know, listen, I think that if you really break it down, you're talking about a fun, cool e-commerce play with Ryan Cohn behind it at this point, but you're also talking about this NFT marketplace. There's so many other ways that they can kind of raise revenue. And you know, I think there really is, the sky's the limit. There is also there's two different worlds. There's the sort of people who believe in the company, and then also there's people who believe that it's a great short opportunity or continuing to be a great short opportunity. So it's a complicated world out there when it comes to the stock.
Can you explain that to people like myself, who are a bit more of a layman? Your documentary actually does a great job of explaining the economics. I was telling you before we started recording that about 40 minutes of the early part of the film is just setting the stage of all these pieces that lent itself to this thing exploding. And like Ryan Cohen, right, the person who started Chewy.com, which is a dog food or pet food and product company on e-commerce and turned it into a huge company. I think when he came over to GameStop and people were like, oh my God, this Ryan Cohen guy sees value in GameStop, that was kind of like the lighting of the fuse. But the fuse had long since been set, both in what GameStop was doing, kind of what the geography of gaming was at the time, and then what you're saying as well with – I've lost my train of thought, but I think like the pandemic, can you I'm sorry, the Wall Street element of it.
Yeah,
can you explain the short and all that stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. So there were our story starts with sort of the people who saw this as a value investment said, okay, PlayStation, Xbox have new systems coming out. There's value there. It's not a $3 stock. They're going to sell those. They have disk drives. They're not just digital. Most of the argument has been, you can buy your games online. So it's game over for GameStop. Nobody's going to shop in the stores anymore.
And that's the comparison to Blockbuster. They're going to become Blockbuster.
Exactly.
Right.
And Netflix is going to, you know, throw them off the ravine.
Right.
But what happened is, so they saw the value in it that, and they saw that there was another console cycle happening. At the same time, a lot of our subjects started to realize that these hedge funds were heavily short GameStop. And what that means is the hedge funds had basically bet against the company. And them betting against the company, they basically bet against it. And by them betting against it, they are almost pushing the stock further and further down. And it got to the point where, you know, you could borrow a certain percentage of stock from sort of brokers and stuff like that. And in a somewhat synthetic way, there was almost 140% of the stock was shorted, which meant, you know, if there was any sign of it going up, you know, Ryan Cohen or whatever, these shorts were going to get blown out of the water and the price would go up and then they would be forced to sell because the price would go up so high. There's a lot of controversy over whether it was technically a gamma squeeze, which is a bit harder to explain, a short squeeze, or whether some people even believe there was no short squeeze and that the price increase was all based on retail investors getting involved. But the evidence does suggest there was a short squeeze. I can't say what's going to happen in the future, but basically that short squeeze happened because of three things. You had people who believed in an undervalued company, these shorts believing it was dead and they were going to continue to pound it down into the ground to bet against it per se. And then you had Ryan Cohen come on, which helped shoot up the price. And sort of then you had sort of the Wall Street Bets and online community come on to really keep buying and raising the price along with Ryan Cohen. And as that price went up, these hedge funds had to sell off their shares that they had shorted or sell off their positions. And they lost billions and billions of dollars. Yeah.
Which is nuts. And we watched the stock. I mean, at the beginning of the pandemic, this stock is $2 maybe. Is that right? And then in that
$2.80. You're talking about it was nothing.
Right. So you could have bought hundreds of these things, thousands of these things. And the people that you follow in the documentary are buying at in mass on this stuff. One of them is a financial advisor. And for his clients in the Midwest, they're farmers, they're blue collar people. He's putting the bet into the GameStop because he sees exactly what you're saying. Maybe, you know, if I just buy a bunch of $2.80 stocks, if this thing just goes to $5, which is probably going to happen with new consoles from Xbox and Sony coming out, it's probably going to happen that this thing goes to $5. I'll make, you know, Jerry down the street some money so that he can, you know, breathe a little, you know, a little easier because he has a farm, right? You got this financial advisor as one of the characters in the film, and none of them could have imagined that this stock was going to hit $40 and then go into the hundreds. And they're buying these things for $2.80. We all looked up. Oh, sorry. Matt Kelly just added a show to the Geekscape Network. That's what that siren means, I guess.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm the one in New York, yeah, and the siren's going off at your end.
Oh, yeah, Geekscapist. That's the Geekscape Network just getting bigger. That's the inside joke here because Matt is adding shows at such a pace. So when you get this idea in December, you'd seen kind of like that September, October Ryan Cohen boost where three of these things had been triggered and the stock went to what point? At what point in December of 2020 did you start thinking, hey, maybe we have a movie here?
Listen, I don't think we decided we had a movie till February. I think that, you know, I'd been hearing about this from sort of a quirky friend for almost all of the year of 2020.
And he's on Reddit or something, and he's in.
He is. Yeah, he's in all those communities. I wouldn't say he's Reddit. He was really a Mark Michael Burry guy. He saw Michael Burry investing this in 2019, and he was super, super, super early. I wouldn't say, you know, our subjects are the ones who are sort of doing the interesting due diligence. This sort of friend of mine was one who was like, "Wow, this is cool, and I see what's happening here, and I'm on board." But he wasn't, you know, doing analysis and creating charts and understanding. Mm-hmm. It wasn't in that. He was sort of absorbing other people's information. The subjects in our film were the people creating that data based off of stuff they saw or sort of, you know, even, you know, the due diligence of the retail community and the small investment houses like Domo Capital, Justin, who you were talking about earlier, is really incredible and, you know, unrivaled, you know, by the hedge funds in this particular situation.
I loved that sequence of the movie where you realize that this community of Redditors or people who are watching on streams, they're sitting at home, like you said, in front of the computers. And in the process of doing that and having this community of X number of people, they're able to do the research and analysis on this stock and on the marketplace better than the hedge funds can. They're just more of them. And they have time on their hands during the pandemic. And they did a pretty insane analysis of not only can this stock hit 40, the stock can actually skyrocket well past it if certain things fall into place. And as you watch this film, and I guess when you started realizing a year ago that let's rock on this movie. At that point in January, this thing had popped in insane way. And then you started to have the issue with Robin Hood and the Congress taking a look at it. What was happening when you finally said, hey, let's make this movie? This is actually a phenomenon. And Hollywood was also paying attention at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, so it is interesting. I decided to do this movie because I wasn't going to do this without basically exclusive access to our subjects, because, you know, no financier is going to distribute something where it's people who are sort of doing everything. So it was really just getting these subjects and being like, all right, they trust me, I trust them, we're going to tell this story together. And again, see where it goes, because there was a lot of things left to come. When we decided to do this, the congressional hearings hadn't happened yet, you know, and, you know, you could say what you will about them. You know, I don't think much came from them in the end, but, you know, the sort of the aftermath of Robin Hood hadn't fully developed yet, you know? So we basically had to say, okay, this is the story we have now, and what's the story to come, and where is this going? And I think that I sort of always see this as like an origin story for this new movement in general. Like, GameStop was the first of sort of many of these, not just meme stocks, like a participation of retail in a way that's never been seen before. And you know what? Listen, Robin Hood, as kind of messed up what they did and sort of as clunky as their business became, you know, gave access to a lot of people, you know, who wouldn't be investing otherwise. And, you know, there are other sort of markets like that as well. But Robin Hood really is the face of that retail trading platform.
Were they the only ones that were quote unquote forced somehow to freeze when this thing hit $261 or so, whatever it hit, and people started being like, hey, it's time to go out. The squeeze has been squozed. Like, this short squeeze, which forced all of these hedge funds to completely collapse their shorts, you squeezed them completely and all the juice is out. Now it's time to go. A lot of people turned on their Robinhood and selling this GameStop stock had been frozen. Were there other apps
There were a few others, but it wasn't a matter of each app kind of was a little bit different in how they approached it. One, maybe you couldn't buy options on it, or but typically with Robinhood, it was they stopped the buying of GameStop. And if you stop
buying, jump on it, right?
It's supply and demand. Like, you know, right. It's going to crash. So truth be told, this stock should have gone way higher and the hedge fund should have been in a lot deeper. Because, I mean, who knows? Listen, nobody really – people say the stock could go to $1 million a share in the right squeeze situation. I don't know that. I'm not an expert. The people I talked to thought it could have gone way higher. You know, it could have gone to 1,000 maybe. But maybe more. I don't know. But them stopping trading, you know, put an end to that and stop the hedge funds bleeding quite a bit. That being said, you know, there is this one thing that we sort of really investigated and looked into – was did sort of these big companies like Citadel or Point72, did they push Robinhood because of their relationship to stop trading? And there's really no evidence to that point. And Rod Alsman says it best that he thinks that their communication was terrible and that it was a liquidity issue.
That Robinhood just couldn't, if people wanted to start selling, Robinhood would have never been able to cover that stuff.
I mean, it basically... Robinhood couldn't handle that trading. They weren't going to be able to cover. Basically, their entire business model would collapse had they didn't. And you know what? It makes sense. It was a once in a lifetime type of situation where these guys weren't prepared for it as their company was sort of progressing. But you know, that's probably what I believe. There was definitely something more nefarious, you know, a little bit in the weeds there, but. From all the evidence that I've seen and all the experts I've talked to, including some of our subjects, it seems that it was just they were terrible communicating what was happening. Again, totally wrong for them to shut it down, and it took money out of the hands of retail investments, as Justin Doverdahl said. It took money out of their hands and into the hedge funds by stopping the trading, but it may have been because of it a bit inadvertent because of, you know, them being not able to handle what was really happening.
But you started to see the ripple effect, and I remember when I had an ex roommate Mark, who's now into like the NFT stuff that I'm very cynical about, and he's into the crypto and that stuff. This is different. This is the stock market. This is the regulated one that people are into that's existed for a very long time. And you're right. Robinhood and those apps give access. But you did see, and I remember Mark telling me, hey, have you seen this GameStop thing? And this is probably January when everything was really starting to skyrocket there. And I kept thinking, dude, it's too late to jump on this GameStop train. It probably was. It was probably around $100, $120 at that time. I could have doubled the money, but that, you know, at that point, it's a little bit more of an investment.
2020 is always hindsight. I mean, 2020. What if Robinhood? What if Robinhood cut it off at $100? What would have happened? You know,
exactly. And, but you did start seeing Matt Kelly still adding shows to the network. This is fantastic. Matt, slow down. I'm going to have to cut Matt Kelly off. Is what I'm going to have to do. Matt, no, we don't have the liquidity for all these podcasts. One thing that you did start to see is that ripple effect where like AMC and like TGI Fridays or whatever, all these other stocks started to get affected by people looking for that next kind of unicorn.
Yeah.
But was that amateur analysis compared to what our team here in the documentary had done, the subjects of your film?
Wait, say that again. Sorry.
Like when you start to see like AMC or like TGI Fridays or whatever the other meme, like, are these meme stocks? Like whatever
AMC,
these other stocks
Tootsie Roll,
start doing.
BlackBerry. Listen, in the end, the GME, there's a lot of GME purists, GameStop purists who believe that none of those other stocks have fundamental reasons. But it gets to a larger issue. You know what I mean? Like BlackBerry shouldn't have been going up. They don't have fundamental reasons to go up. They don't have a Ryan Cohen. They don't have the Microsoft deal. They don't have these things.
I don't think they have products anymore, do they?
I believe they do. But
Didn't they shut down BlackBerry's thing a while ago?
I'm not even sure, to be honest.
I don't even know.
They're still a company.
It. Just kidding.
Maybe their data, right. maybe they're business facing or probably sure. Part of what they are. But here's the thing that's crazy. This thing developed after our story, which I think is the story of these people who started it all, there's this new story that developed. And this new story, you know, people refer to them as the apes. And you know, these are people, some of them who bought it at 300 and then lost a lot, but are holding this stock because It's a statement. It's a statement that they're going to hold the stock and just like with AMC and wait for it to squeeze. And if they keep holding it and buying more, it's going to squeeze the hedge funds even more.
And this, maybe it'll hit 1,000 is what they're hoping.
Sometimes
for.
They think it'll hit 1,000,000. You know, and again,
these
like,
are the diamond hands people.
The diamond
these
hands.
People who are like diamond hands, baby, yep. Hard as a rock. I'm not letting go of this thing. I mean, you start to see that when Doge dipped. You started to see the people being like, buy the dip, and they're on the train. The Doge stuff and why I'm skeptical of the crypto thing is it just feels like if somebody goes on SNL and says a few words and completely – like it feels like this stuff is very influencer-based with some of these crypto stocks. And if somebody can go on and use this wide – like this huge influence to affect the thing – it's not the democratization of the financial department at all.
Well,
very manipulable.
Well, listen, Elon Musk, in a way, you know, did this for GameStop. He tweeted GameStonk in the middle of this, and the stock skyrocketed.
That's
you
right.
know, the question is, what is manipulation?
So there is an equivalent to it, yeah.
There is. No, I think I'm not an expert in what market manipulation is. It seems like there was an effort on part of the government to accuse some subjects in the film or some subjects sort of out in the world of GameStop of manipulating the market. You know, Roaring Kitty, for instance, was, you know, got into some trouble for that. But I think it's unfounded. Like, he didn't manipulate the market. He had a stream where he gave due diligence, you know, and
very due diligence.
Yeah. I mean, this is not just a pump scheme that, you know, is happening on TikTok with a very specific meme coin. You know,
right?
And also, it's a big difference because a lot of these meme coins you can't even sell. You hold them, and then there's nobody to buy them, and the market crashes.
So, what do you think when like somebody like a Jimmy Fallon, Paris Hilton, they talk about these, you know, Bored Ape NFTs, whatever the heck they do on their show? Like, a part of me, and the cynic in me, because I'm not. Again, I've said it. I've gotten criticism from the audience before on the whole NFT thing. They called me a boomer, Jonah. They called me a boomer. I'm barely even Generation X, like, at this point. I'm like a year off from not even being Generation X.
My girlfriend
this whole
calls
idea,
me a boomer every day, though, so don't
yeah,
worry.
And the whole, and one of your financial people in the documentary gets called a boomer. The whole idea is that I get worried about the NFT thing, and my own criticism of the NFT thing is independent of what is happening with these influencer stocks or influencer memes, meme stocks is or NFTs, is that NFTs are easily mined, and a lot of these, they're just not fleshed out in the way that the stock market is. So again, a comic book artist or a musician can have their work mined independently of their knowledge. They show up in a gallery somewhere and suddenly they get a cease and desist that this thing has been replicated in the gallery and minted, and they have to stop selling the artwork online. So it really makes anybody who puts their artwork online vulnerable to a lot of this stuff. Once that gets ironed out, y'all can NFT it up all you freaking want. But if it's hurting artists, which is the one thing it was claiming to not do, which was the one thing it was claiming to do the opposite of, then I can't get behind it. Does that make sense,
Jonah? Yeah, I mean, I'm not an NFT expert by any means, but I see the value in it. I see the value of blockchain and how these artists will continue to get paid. Like, what if Picasso's estate was still getting paid off of the resale, which is something that happens with NFTs? But at the same time, like, you know, I think it's like anything. It's a collectible. You think about baseball cards, you think about all sorts of sports cards. Like, the values of some of these things are incredible. Cards that come out in 2020 that are sold for millions of dollars. You know, who's to say that, you know, I think you think of the NFTs as, you know, I talked to a friend who's a big CryptoPunks enthusiast, which is one of the original sort of NFT artists, and he has one of them, and he's a full believer in it. And he says something to the effect of, this is the first piece of art from a digital revolution. You know what I mean? And you know, in the metaverse one day, you're going to have your own gallery, and that's where it's going to be. And it's represented in this sort of new kind of, you know, financial, you know, Bitcoin or Ethereum. And that is, and listen, in the end, these iconic artists are always going to be valuable, because if you're one of the guys, if you're one of those 5 or 10 guys, Bored Ape, Beeple, you know, CryptoPunks, they're always going to be valuable, because they're always going to be the scarcity of the being the first ones, the ones that,
sure,
you know, but it's, you know, it's hard, because there's a lot of fraud we're reading about too, where it's, you know, I could make something, sell it to you for $100,000 in Ethereum, then all of a sudden it's worth $100,000. But, like, you know, I gave you the $100,000 and then you sold it for $50,000 and we've made $50,000 profit, even though we're taking a loss because someone sees it on the blockchain. And again, I'm no expert, but I know that stuff like that's been going on. That being said, you know, it's going to be very interesting. Some of the art's cool. Yeah. Some of the art's cool.
And some of the art's terrible.
Some of the art's not theirs.
I'm watching this artwork and I'm like, that's barely artwork. Like, that's horrid.
Have you seen
that's somebody
stuff?
Figuring out an iPad.
Beeple's stuff is cool. Like, it is cool. It is exactly what you'd expect, like, these cool NFTs to be.
I'm down with that.
Yeah. Like collections of just, you know, intergalactic sci-fi. Like, it's cool.
So, with the stock thing, and we're talking about, like, there's no manipulation that doesn't happen. These hedge funds, like, the whole community, and I feel like GameStop was the beginning of things that did turn into crypto and NFT, and this whole to the moon revolution of, like, we're going to diamond hands this thing. We're not selling. We're all in this together. And as long as we're all in this together, we can take it to the man. The man being represented in your film is like these hedge funds. And it feels at some point like this is a little bit of the pitchforks thing, or it's like, you know what, these 1%, 0.0001% really, like, we're going to take them down. And you start to see those marches on Wall Streets and things like that. You have a portion of that in your film. How much did you document of that whole thing? Because it feels cyclical, right? Like, we used to have the 99% 5 years ago, 6 years ago, doing this. Now it seems like every 5 years we have these marches on Wall Street. How much did you document that?
I thought about it a lot. I mean, I think that, you know, listen, the Occupy 2.0 that's happening, Occupy Wall Street was a movement that we all understood what it was all about, but there was no end game to it. There was no, okay, so what do we want? Down with the hedge funds, down with the financial systems, Goldman Sachs close your doors. That's not going to happen. If Goldman Sachs closes doors, like, it's going to send ripples that, you know, change everything. Regulation, collapse. That could happen. But there was no regulation. There was nothing that happened.
And we saw a lot of that happen in the pandemic. And people are being left with the bag right now for a lot of these places collapsing being dented in the pandemic. I think Biden's doing as well a job as possible to try and figure out and navigate this thing. Because that pandemic hit things across the board. We are literally a country trying to pick itself back up and get the gears moving again.
Well, Blake always says, you know, this story would not have happened if not for COVID. And I think he's right in that.
Agreed.
COVID put people in their homes. It gave them something else they need to do. A lot of it, you know, the stimulus checks too, really, I think, became a lot of people's investment, you know, money as well. You know, people aren't
spending. So you got $1,200 and you put it all in GameStop, huh?
Yeah, I think a lot of people did that. You know, Jen, as one of our subjects, was out of work at the time, and she was able to put all her savings in stuff like GameStop because she was getting an unemployment check that she wouldn't have normally got otherwise. It was a big boost. In a sense, I guess, you know, the government stimulated the economy by giving money for people to invest on Robinhood and all this stuff, which is really crazy if you think about it. Also crypto, you know, the value of crypto has gone up over the past few years and people are taking those crypto monies and they bought that dip of COVID. And I think a lot of the people who made real crazy money on GameStop were people who brought that money in for crypto and saw an opportunity.
Oh my God. I remember that money got deposited in my account and like 3 hours later it was gone because I had to get a root canal.
Oh no.
I was waiting in the dentist's office and I was like, oh, thank God I got that stimulus because I'm about to get a root canal. And I walked out and I was like, there with the stimulus. I could have put it in the GameStop. I put it in my freaking teeth.
You know that
don't eat candy, Geekscape.
What about a lot
don't
of
eat sugar?
A lot of shares when it was at $3 a share, you know?
Yeah.
But the thing that's interesting is, so, you know, we talk about the previous, the Occupy Wall Street and The Big Short. It's an incredible, incredible movie. Okay. Incredible movie. When you think about The Big Short, all of these different characters who had sort of discovered this thesis per se that, you know, the housing market's going to collapse, they were all separate. They weren't overlapping. They were all doing their own thing and discovered it separately. What was interesting about this is because of COVID, all of our people in this story were talking online and they were sharing research. Like financial people don't typically share research. It's all proprietary. So I always thought of this as like, oh, this is The Big Short, but these people all happen to come online and become friends together. And that sort of, that was probably the thing that got me the most interested in the story. It's like, oh, wow, Big Short, one of my favorite movies. I see the story. This doc is similar in a sense that you have these people from all walks of life who are finding the same idea, the same thesis, and they're actually coming together. And that was really special, I thought.
There is a heart in this film that I told you early on before we started that about 30 minutes of this movie early on is laying those pieces. And that can be pretty dense information, Geekscapist. But Jonah does a great job of laying this out. You know, he introduces you to all these players individually, but we start to get their stories. We start to see them meet each other online and start to have the conversation and comparison of notes, as Jonah just said. The animation helps. The filmmaking is really strong on this stuff, dude. You did a really great job of parsing the information out. And even for a dumb like me, parsing the information out in a way that it was manageable for the audience. You then get to a couple sections where we get to learn some of these people better, right? Jen goes through something really scary. And then the human stuff gets taken to another level. And you're just rooting for them at this point. You're like, you know what? I don't even care if this thing goes to 40. I want this thing to go to hundreds because you've been with these people for a year and a half of their lives, 2 years of their lives as they've been narrating. We want to see them win, you know? And there's not necessarily a villain in the film. There are a couple people on the hedge fund side who are prominent. They've been doing the same job they've always been doing. And they say, hey, that's my job. On this one, I was massively wrong. But I think he did a pretty good job of parsing the information out, giving us a human element, and doing it in a digestible way. So Geekscape, if this is a movie that interests you, don't wait for the VOD. Like, it's in theaters now. Maybe you'll get it to VOD. I don't know. Don't wait. I told somebody this morning. They said, where can I see it? And I said, you got to go to theaters. If you feel safe going to theaters, we're doing pretty good, Geekscapists. Keep wearing your masks. I think this is a fun one to watch.
I really enjoyed watching it in theaters. Like it, you know, we have a big, bold score by Jeff Beal. Jeff Beal, if you don't know him, is a multiple Emmy winner. Way back, he's done some of the top docs, you know, Blackfish and recently Biggest Little Farm. And, you know, he also did the music for House of Cards. You know, he created that beautiful, bold House of Cards theme, And one of my all-time favorites, he did the music for Monk, but and Console Wars, of course. But yeah. You know, that big House of Cards, you know, orchestral thematic music you see when we bring on these sort of villains, the hedge funds. You know, even though, you know, it's arguable, hedge funds, you know, as a concept are a bit villainous, but we also forget that, like, oftentimes they're managing the money of, like, pension funds and, like, fire, you know, like you know, it's yes. their money and they're
state,
making
state
huge
teachers
rips on it.
And things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a more complicated issue. But that being said, like, the hubris that some of them acted with is really, it was pretty shocking in the case of GameStop. And, you know, being from
New
York,
they're not all Bernie Madoff. I don't think they're all Bernie Madoff, no.
No, well, I mean, Bernie Madoff is another thing altogether. But, you know, being from New York, you come across different hedge fund people over time. And I've known people at a lot of the big hedge funds and you know, no one at the highest levels. But, you know, they're just really just trying to make their money before they eventually get fired for not making money. It's a rat race. No, it really is. It's the fear of these guys
who make was on Wall Street.
Millions yes. of dollars, 30 years old, making millions of dollars. But, like, they're about to get cut off at any time. You know what I mean? And the amount of regulation they deal with is a lot. It's just, it's a crazy world. But in this particular case, these hedge funds acted with such incredible hubris that, you know, it's pretty hard not to dislike them. Although, as much Andrew Left, who sort of was painted as the bad guy, you know, mm-hmm. in our film, you know,
I didn't want to say that. I mean, he was pretty brave for being in the film.
Yeah. You know, you what, know? When yeah. we talked to him, we decided, listen, I think it's important to have all sides, and, you know, you're not going to get Melvin Capo talk. These hedge fund guys have no value. There's no value for them to talk to you. They're just going to keep doing their doing. You know, someone said something to me recently. It's like, oh, well, you know, Gabe Plotkin didn't make $700 million this year. He only made 150. And it's like, well, I guess that in the grand scheme of things, but, yeah, Andrew Left, and we only wanted to talk to him if he was going to be honest and really just tell us how it was. And if you watch the movie, he really does, you know, some of the things he says. And we try to let him present his point, and I think we do, but he's really funny and charismatic, and I think that, I think it's very interesting to see his perspective, despite, you know, coming in and saying literally the first line being, oh, we're bad guys, we're evil, you know, that's what people think, you know. But we also show Tom Barton, who's a short seller or has a short selling history past, and, you know, he kind of tells you sort of what short selling used to be. You know, it used to be you bet on these companies that you know are frauds because, hey, it's much easier to bet on a company that's a fraud and you know is going to bankrupt, or bet against, rather, than bet on a company that, you know, potentially could go up. But
what was the ratio like on your footage? Like, how, like, because you had such a truncated window for you and Blake to make this movie, like, a lot of it's in the movie, isn't it?
Well, I would say so. We early on identify who the subjects are based on pre-interviews, and we do a lot of pre-interviewing so that we know exactly what the story is before we go in. You know, there'll be surprises, but we talk to these subjects enough that we know, you know, they're ordinary people. These are people who are not normally sitting down for interviews. We know how to pace an interview where we go on for 4, 5, 6 hours and we get what we need and we pace it so that, you know, by hour 2 or 3, we're really getting into the good stuff and, you know, making sure that we get the full story of what, you know, we might not necessarily want to do as much backstory with a certain person because we feel like they might burn out. So each subject, we probably spent, you know, we spent like full days with them, you know, shooting B-roll, but also sometimes 2 days. But the interviews were typically, you know, you had a setup for a couple hours and then, you know, you interview them for maybe 5, 6 hours. And then, you know, the archival hunt is a real thing. I think that we really wanted to make, you know, we had an archival person working before we even started shooting. So we were gathering all the archival of the story, and at the same time gathering all the social media. We wanted this to be a film of the internet. We wanted the memes. We wanted to show the energy of this story through these memes and through these social media posts, you know. And we had a full-time person just gathering sort of all of that and going back and just kind of going through all our subjects, going through Reddit, going through every sort of potential thing. And, that, and, you know, you definitely saw all that meme culture in the film.
It's awesome. I mean, it's part of the humor of the film. Like, you laugh out loud at some of this stuff. But, I mean, it's also stuff that you literally saw yesterday. That's how aggressively quick you guys made this movie. The memes aren't even old yet. Like, this is a pretty incredible feat. And I think there are a number of Hollywood adaptations planned or the, you know, other rival documentaries, and y'all came out of the gate and beat all of them. That's
insane. Yeah, it wasn't about racing. I mean, it was, you know, our distributor kind of set a deadline for us, and it kind of got us excited to do it fast and do it efficiently. This wasn't efficient. I mean, listen, we definitely lost years off our life on this one, but you know, it was fun and it was wild. And the idea that we would be planning to come out on the 1 year anniversary, you know, Neon and Super LTD, who are distributors, are, you know, honestly, they've only been around 4 years, but they're like the best of all the independent distributors out there. They're the best. They win Oscars almost every year. They are, you know, putting out some of the coolest content. I don't know if you saw today, the Oscar nominations, Flea, their documentary got the first ever film to be nominated in three categories, best,
because it's an foreign animation
film.
As well.
Yeah, it got best foreign film, best animation, and best documentary. Unbelievable. Who else would do that but Neon? And
pretty awesome.
Yeah, they're incredible. And so they basically, you know, they're a little bit scrappier than some of the streamers. And, you know, we had other opportunities, but it was like we had to go with them. And they were able to make the deal. You know, typically a Hollywood deal could take 4 or 5 months to do. They made it quickly. They let us go right away. But in return, they wanted to try to get it out on the 1 year anniversary because they are great marketing people. And we did it and we did it at the highest level. I mean, you know, if you look at that animation, obviously you typically couldn't make in that level. We had, you know, one of the best composers in the game. We, you know what I mean? And we really crafted this in a way that, you know, it's a film that takes 2 or 3 years, I think, but we had a team in place. We used almost the exact same team, Console Wars. We had our supervising editor, Doug Blush, who has multiple Oscar wins. We had Josh Bayer and Henry editing again. We had, you know, we brought in Jeff again to do the music, and then Mindbomb to do the animation. So we had the infrastructure, and it was basically like, as the deal was happening, I was like, all right, guys, can we do this? And everybody kind of dropped what they were doing, and we did it.
Dude, congratulations. I really hope that, I mean, is the Console Wars narrative over at Legendary yet, or is it still, or wherever the heck it is?
The Console Wars.
It bounced a little.
Yeah, so if you don't know, Console Wars, initially, we sold it to Sony Pictures, Columbia Pictures, with Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg, and Scott Rudin, who produced The Social Network. It was supposed to be sort of the Social Network of video games. Time went by. They wanted to turn it into a limited, because limited series is more interesting. Sony TV couldn't do it. We resold the film, the film rights based on the book and the doc, to Legendary Pictures, which is a big outfit. And then they were going to make it the first original, or one of the early originals for Paramount Plus. Yes, yeah, a series.
It was going to be a series.
A limited series. Yeah. It was going to be limited. It was going to be a series. It was basically 2 seasons in 16 bits, 16 episodes, which would, cool. I think, is a lot of fun. We had a great team behind it. The pilot was being directed by Jordan Vogt Roberts, who does the King Kong movies, Legendary as well, and you know he's done great film and TV. And Mike Rosolia was writing the script. COVID happened, and it didn't move forward because of that. So right now, Blake and I, we can't really talk about it, but we have another plan moving forward on that one, which is kind of exciting. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Let me send a text. Blake, what is that? Just kidding, Blake. Blake's actually he's on YouTube right now with the chat room with y'all. And he's saying, Mind Bomb.
Mind Bomb is the animation company that we work with.
That's the animation company. They were awesome. And Blake, good luck on the book you're working on now. I think that's a cool subject. All right, let's get you out of here.
All right. You sure you don't have anything else? Get anything else?
No. You got to go make dinner. You're on a different time zone.
You notice how it's gotten dark behind me?
It's got dark. Geekscapist, you need to go out and find this movie. It's called GameStop, Rise of the Players. It's about people like you who, you know, if you've discovered Geekscape, you probably spent some time on the internet, some time on your phone, looking at sites like Reddit and social media and all this stuff and buying up the memes and the stocks and the... all that stuff. I'm a boomer. Don't talk to me about it. But this is a movie about y'all. I think it's fantastic. I had so much fun watching this thing, Jonah. Congratulations on it, dude.
Thanks so much.
Congratulations. This is just awesome. And congratulations to Blake. Whenever we get around to seeing each other again, I'm doing a New York trip. I want to congratulate y'all in person.
Let me know. I'd love to meet you in person.
All right. That'd be so much fun. Geekscapist again, GameStop, Rise of the Players in theaters right now. Thanks, Jonah, for being on the show. And you can follow Jonah on Twitter to find out when it hits that VOD window. It's at Jonah Tullis on Twitter. JonahTullis. I can spell. Do you know? That's crazy. I can read. Jonah, best of luck, man. You need anything from Geekscape, let us know.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Of course, of course. And Geekscape, this is Geekscape. Share it with your friends. We got an episode coming up a little later this week. It might be over the weekend, where Ian and I are going to be talking all about this season of Book of Boba Fett. That's our big wrap-up special on Book of Boba Fett. It's been pretty controversial as far as Star Wars fans go. We're going to have a lot to talk about, so you're not going to want to miss that. Subscribe, share, do all the things you do with Geekscape. I'm Jonathan, and for Jonah, I'd like to say thank you. Don't hate, create. Over and out.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.